Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for, well, an intelligence briefing on what I call the war for the free world. In that war, we have both foreign fronts and domestic. And at the moment, the latter has just been enlivened considerably by the pronouncements of the President of the United States last night that he is extending a temporary delay of deportation for perhaps as many as 4 or more million currently resident illegal aliens. To talk about that decision, its implications, and likely repercussions, I am thrilled to have with us Mark Krikorian. He is the executive director of a terrific organization, the Center for Immigration Studies in Washington, D.C. He is the author of How Obama is Transforming America Through Immigration and a new book entitled Open Immigration, Yay or Nay. Mark Krikorian, welcome back. I know you've got a very full plate at the moment. Thank you for finding time to talk with us a bit about the president's decision and what's likely to come from it.
Well, glad to be here.
So talk, Mark, first of all, about what the terms of this announced initiative are. To whom does it apply, and how many folks do you think will be covered?
Well, there are a whole bunch of things that Obama decreed yesterday on immigration, but the big one, as you suggested, is this amnesty provision. And actually, there's a couple of separate amnesty things, and they might actually add up to about 5 million illegal immigrants getting work permits and driver's licenses and Social Security numbers. And that's the important point to make here. The president actually did not tell the truth, should be no surprise, in his speech last night, where he said, as speaking to the illegal immigrants, all we're saying is we're not going to deport you. In other words, he was saying that this is just going to be kind of looking the other way. And the thing is that he's been doing that since 2009. What he announced last night was not a passive looking the other way. It's actually an active provision of rights and benefits. It's a de facto legalization. It gives them work permits, Social Security numbers, driver's licenses, and there's nothing temporary about it. It will have to be renewed every 3 years, but, you know, I renew my driver's license periodically, too. No one who has ever gotten a temporary status like this, and we have a separate statutory system that gives this kind of temporary status that's actually legal. No one who's ever gotten that, ever, has been made to leave because it expired. So no one who actually gets this, if in fact it ends up being implemented and Congress doesn't stop it, no one who gets it will ever be made to leave the country because it expired. So it's not, in fact, temporary.
Yeah, and you know, Mark, as you say, this is not unique in this president's history, but it does translate into another example of fraud. And the fact that it is being endlessly repeated by the media and by his admirers and those in the affected community, most especially by this characterization as temporary, really is adding insult to our intelligence and injury to, I think, our national security, among other things. Mark, the implications of this in terms of the system, I'm going to talk a little bit about this with Clara Davilar of the Hispanic Post momentarily, but I'd like to get your thoughts on it as well. We're told the immigration system is broken. Is this likely to contribute to making it a better system, or is it going to make things vastly worse?
No, this will clearly bog down the immigration system for a long time. President Obama did something like this through immigration diktat a couple of years ago, where he legalized unilaterally and illegally almost 600,000 so-called dreamers. These were illegal immigrants who came at a young age. There may even be a case for something like that. I'm actually for some version of something like that, but the Congress voted it down, the actual bill, which was a bad bill, and President Obama just said, well, I'm going to do it anyway. I don't care whether Congress wants it or not. The point here is that that program legalized only 600,000 instead of 5 million, and yet it caused long delays for legal immigrants trying to get their paperwork processed. And maybe more importantly for the long term, they had to cut corners on security checks. They did what was called lean and light security checks. If I want my government doing background checks on foreigners, I don't want the words lean and light in front of that. And yet, with 5 million people applying, God knows how lean and light the security checks will be. All kinds of bad guys are going to slip through because there just isn't the capacity to do what's necessary.
And Mark, in that respect, one thing that's particularly troubling is the background check, it seems, is going to start with nothing more than the representation of the individual being checked as to who he or she may be. Is that right?
Probably. I mean, they often do fingerprint checks as well, but they have to have fingerprints.
Fingerprints on file in order to establish whether they're somebody else. Yeah.
Right, exactly. And, you know, we've seen repeatedly all kinds of bad guys slip through our relatively weak system for screening out people. And in fact, you know, they're only screening out people who have, you know, who reached a pretty high bar of being bad guys. There's all kinds of lesser people who graduate to being terrorists or cartel assassins or what have you because they were merely car thieves or something else before that, and we ignored it.
Right. And in fact, in cases that we've discussed in the past, Mark, the president has let people, even some who've had violent criminal histories, out of prison, turning them loose into our society rather than deporting them. So this is unlikely to get better, needless to say. Again, our guest is Mark Krikorian. He's the executive director of an organization that I value very highly, the Center for Immigration Studies. You can check it out at cis.org. Let me ask you about something you mentioned, you alluded to a moment ago, Mark, but it's so critical here. Is what the president has done with these various decisions legal? I was listening to an interview this morning on NPR's Cecilia Munoz was interviewed about the statements the president himself had made some 22 times in recent months to the effect that he does not have the authority, maybe not recent months, but over the past couple of years, that he does not have the authority to do what he has done here. She said, oh, well, no, he was talking about other things that he didn't do, but he's got the authority to do this. What do you believe the truth is?
I defer to constitutional scholar Obama, who, like you said, Speaker Boehner, John Boehner, his office has compiled 22 instances where he said he does not have the power to do this. In fact, he specifically said after the amnesty that he decreed in 2012 for the Dreamers, it's called Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, that was bad enough. But after that, he said, well, look, I don't have authority to do that for any more people, to broaden that program that I announced recently. Well, what he just did last night was broaden that program. In other words, there's a writer who says every statement out of Obama comes with an expiration date. And that seems to be the case here. What they're doing is relying not on legal precedents, but on they're using them as pretexts. No president, no Congress ever has imagined that the law would permit the legalization of millions of people. And yet that's what they're doing, and he's going to see if he can get away with it.
Okay, well, this brings us to our last question. We've just got a minute left, Mark Krikorian. What can Congress do to stop this?
The key thing is cut off money. Congress has the power of the purse, and so there's a fight even now where some of the leadership essentially wants to forfeit that weapon and want unilateral disarmament by approving a funding bill through the end of the fiscal year, end of September next year. If that happens, then Obama gets away with it, because anything Congress does will just be impotent fulmination.
But do you believe that they have the power to prevent this if, as some have said, it is funded? The principal mechanism for doing all of these processes would be user fee funded?
They are fees. The agency that does this, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, is funded almost entirely through fees. But they can't spend the fees unless Congress authorizes them to spend the fees. There are many available weapons to use the power of the purse if the congressional leadership actually wants to do it.
And that's the rub. They may not. And if they don't fight this, let's be clear, folks, they are complicit in President Obama's lawlessness, and there's no question but there will be more where this came from over the next 2 years. Mark Krikorian, I cannot tell you how much I appreciate your leadership, your clarity on these issues, and your help in making all of us more effective in countering what the president is doing in this particular wrecking operation and act of fraud. Keep up the good work at the Center for Immigration Studies and come back to us again very soon. Next up, we will be speaking with Clara de Villar. We'll get the perspective of the editor-in-chief of the Hispanic Post on the president's decision and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
If you listen to this radio station a lot, you may have noticed our brand new name. It's got a catchy ring to it. But there's more than that. The name actually tells you who we are and what we do in one word. It took us a while to come up with this, but we realized if there's one thing we want to be to DC listeners, it was this. We want to be your answer to everything, to what happened while you slept, to why am I stuck in traffic, to how do you get control of this country again. Big stuff and little stuff. This may be a tall order for one radio station, but we know we're up for it. AM 1260, The Answer.
Great news for fans of Secure Freedom Radio. Now you can watch original Frank Gaffney and Center for Security Policy video content every day from the comfort of your living room. What makes this possible? A new video streaming service called Roku. All you need is a Roku player and a television to join the millions of Americans who customize their home viewing experience using the more than 1,000 Roku channels to access movies, TV shows, music, and more. When you add the cost-free Secure Freedom Roku channel, you'll gain unlimited streaming access to vital video products of the center, including Secure Freedom Radio, Capitol Hill and National Press Club events, intelligence briefings, Frank Gaffney's acclaimed 10-part Muslim Brotherhood in America course, and more. The Secure Freedom Roku channel integrates information and entertainment, establishing a new media battle space in the war for the free world. Go to securefreedom.org/ROKU today to learn how you can be a part of it. We hope you'll see us soon.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts. Now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say, joined by a friend of many years, Clara Del Villar. She is today the founder, CEO, and editor-in-chief of an important new digital platform for communicating with the Hispanic community about matters of news and other information. It is entitled The Hispanic Post. You can find it at hispanicpost.com. She has a long and distinguished history in finance in New York and elsewhere, and joins us from New York City. Welcome, Clara. It's great to have you with us.
Frank, it's a pleasure to be here this morning.
In anticipation of the president's remarks last night, you posed a number of questions that I want to turn to with you now. But let me just ask you for sort of your overall assessment of what he has done with this announcement and its implications.
Frank, I can answer that in a couple of parts. For one thing, I did want to point out my biggest objection to what the president mentioned yesterday in his speech and what he has said repeatedly is that Republicans have not been interested in dealing with the immigration reform issue, or they have not been offering solutions for the immigration reform issue. So I want to say right off of the bat here that, you know, there have been many Republicans that have offered up guest worker program permits as an alternate route to trying to address the 11 million undocumented workers in the United States. The reason I mention that is because I think the biggest obstacle this president has is really making the Hispanic community and the general population feel comfortable with the notion that he's acting on his own. Executive action without congressional or legislative engagement here, I think, is something that will make people feel more uncomfortable than he believes, and particularly the Hispanic population.
We're talking with Clara Del Villar. She is the founder and CEO, as well as editor-in-chief of a digital platform called The Hispanic Post. You can read it at hispanicpost.com. And Clara, we're just going through some issues that you have raised, and I think a very legitimate one is we've heard so much about the broken immigration system. Is it possible that you can do what the president has just done without greatly exacerbating what's been breaking it?
I would say, Frank, absolutely. It will not be an easy road. It will not be an easy path. We have an immigration system that can't take care of, on a timely basis, the legal immigrants that are coming to this country. We do not have a visa tracking system that operates. That is why 60% of our undocumented workers are actually expired visa holders. So the notion that now states, and not just the federal government, but states will be burdened with trying to understand how to get these worker permits to the Hispanic community, the undocumented Hispanic community, and somehow it'll be a smooth and functioning system, to me is a challenging idea to absorb. So I don't think there's any way it'll happen in a timely basis.
That is almost certainly going to be even more true because of some of the ambiguities or at least uncertainties that are associated with the eligibility test, isn't it?
Without question, I think basically how do we really get through the background checks of Hispanics, you know, criminal background checks, penalties? How do we really verify the fact that they've been here for 5 years or more? How do we verify that they're parents of Dreamers, the DACA children? So there's so many levels of testing and background and administrative operation here. To me, I think it's going to take years to absorb this group.
And Clara Del Villar, one of the things that you've touched on there that is particularly troubling, I think, is this question of identity. It's my understanding that basically it's just going to be on people's say-so who they are, and we will begin issuing identity papers, driver's licenses, social security cards, all manner of things as a result. Is that not, well, talk about burdening an already broken system. Is that not really a problem, a national security problem, among other things?
I could absolutely see that. I mean, again, I don't know. The president did not outline who he's going to engage in this immigration background check. Is it going to be the FBI? Are there other going to be security forces here involved, intelligence? Who knows? Essentially, what I'm saying is the verification of all of these millions of undocumented workers is going to be a challenge, without question.
We've actually had some heroic problems with background investigations even before 4 or so million people have been dumped into the system, including a process that has actually resulted in contractors engaging in what has been called flushing of background checks, simply not performing them and yet claiming that they had, that gives rise to, as I say, real, I think, not just problems of identity, but possibly of security. Clara de Villar is our guest. She is the editor-in-chief of the Hispanic Post. And Clara, one other piece of this, and you have a long background, as I mentioned, in finance and working with various corporations. Talk a little bit about the possible exposure of companies in the midst of this to-ing and fro-ing over the president's announcement and possible congressional pushback. Some have quite possibly been employing illegal aliens, and what kind of fix might they be in?
Absolutely. I mean, again, I think that many of these undocumented workers, of course, and again, I want to emphasize, Frank, as we said in the outset, that we feel compassion. We feel the humanity for these people escaping a impoverished life and coming here. So many of them have been employed with companies throughout the nation as undocumented workers. The companies have known that they are undocumented, that they are illegally employed. And essentially, once these workers start registering for workers' permits, the companies will be exposed. The question remains, what if this bill is repealed? That is not out of the line of probability. These companies could be in greater risk for penalties and other possible actions in the years to come. So again, if I were to summarize, I think that this president really made it very simplistic that he's acting on executive action just like Reagan and George H. Bush. But Reagan spent years addressing this issue and working on this issue quietly when he made his announcement. This president seems to have done it very, very impetuously.
And he did work with Congress as well in implementing that amnesty initially. And I think many, including, I believe, President Reagan himself, considered it a mistake in the end that he had extended that amnesty. But, Clara, this is really an important point. We're talking about problems with the illegal aliens themselves and what they may have as a concern. We're talking about a system that is overburdened, corporations possibly having real exposure. All of this is fraught, but one of the things that is particularly worrying is the prospect, if the border is not secured, that this announcement of the president's last night will simply serve as a magnet for still more people to come here and seek pretty much the same deal eventually, if not immediately.
I think that's true, Frank. Again, we have compassion. I want to make sure Republicans are not viewed as being not uncompassionate. But we saw the reaction when the president did the Dreamer Act in late 2011 and how that led to children starting to come across the border unaccompanied to take advantage of the Dreamer Act mistakenly. I have every reason to believe the president has given no reassurance that this won't continue to happen, that we will have ranges of people coming across the border. He's done nothing to assure the American public that we've addressed the illegal immigration flow across our borders.
And that makes all of this vastly more problematic, because if it becomes a magnet, in fact, it makes matters tremendously worse, especially at a time when there are serious problems taking place south of our border, notably but not exclusively in Mexico. Clara de Villar, thank you for what you're doing at the Hispanic Post today. It is an important voice of reason and counsel, it seems to me, about a very, very troubling development last night at the hands of the president. We'll be following it closely, as I know will you, and I hope you'll come back to us with your insights and advice as well. Thank you for joining us. Bill Gertz joins us next. He takes us inside the ring, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
People from around the country have no clue what we're like here in Washington, D.C. Yeah, we've got our whack jobs, like the guy who climbed the fence and walked around the White House. We have the people who see the black helicopters. But there's one common denominator for all of us, friends and family. And there's no place where a relationship means more than it does right here. Yeah, we may be famous for the dignitaries, but friends and family that makes us tick. And frankly, this radio station gets that. That's why I listen. AM 1260. The Answer.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Milton Friedman was certainly a brilliant free market economist, but one of his most telling insights was the quip that, quote, nothing is so permanent as a temporary government program, unquote. You can take it to the bank that President Obama will prove the truth of that adage with the temporary suspension of deportation for millions of illegal aliens that he announced last night. While emphasizing his temporary permission for these aliens to stay legally in this country, the president is also clearing them for work permits. They'll be able to get Social Security cards that have no expiration date. Such credentials are the gateway to green card citizenship and voting rights. Congress has the power to prevent the latest temporary government program from becoming a permanent disaster for America by defunding it now. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
Navigating this world when you are undereducated can be difficult. I'm Dr. Ben Carson, and I know this for a fact. When I was growing up, my family lived in dire poverty, and because of my poor learning skills, my classmates called me dummy. My life began to turn around when my mother encouraged me to read. I went from the bottom of my class to graduating from Yale University and becoming the youngest director of pediatric neurosurgery at Johns Hopkins Hospital. I know how important it is to nurture a child's dream.
When I grow up, I want to become a scientist.
I want to be a doctor, just like Ben Carson.
I hope to become an engineer.
I want to be a teacher or maybe a broadcaster.
The Carson Scholars Fund is impacting schools across the nation by encouraging children to read, write, and excel at math and science so they can realize their dreams. We need your help. To learn more about the Carson Scholars Fund and to donate, visit our website at carsonscholars.org.
After all, the person who has the most to do with your success is you.
This is Center for Security Policy Senior Fellow Fred Flights. With the nuclear talks with Iran possibly ending by a November 24 deadline, an important question is being ignored by the news media. Just how close is Iran to making a nuclear weapon? Well, Iran is much closer to constructing a nuclear bomb than the Obama administration will admit. Using its 9,000 uranium centrifuges, Iran could make enough nuclear fuel for one weapon in 2.2 to 3.5 months. Iran has enough reactor-grade uranium to fuel at least 7 nuclear bombs, possibly more. The agreement being negotiated with Iran reportedly will not reduce the number of bombs Tehran can construct and may only lengthen this deadline by 2 weeks. The nuclear talks amount to appeasement of Iran. Congress should therefore renounce these talks and demand a new approach that fully addresses the threat from Iran's nuclear program. This is Fred Flights of the Center for Security Policy. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined as we have the privilege of being each week by one of the country's preeminent national security reporters and analysts. He is Bill Gertz. He is the senior editor of the Washington Free Beacon and a prize-winning columnist of the Inside the Ring column at the Washington Times. Bill, welcome back. It's always good to have you with us.
Hi, Frank. Good to be on the program.
You've been doing, as usual, extraordinarily important work, breaking stories left and right. And one that I think is really important is the report that you did on a hearing this week involving two gentlemen by the name of Mike Rogers, Admiral Mike Rogers and Chairman Mike Rogers. Tell us what came out of that hearing that should be of concern to absolutely every single American.
Yeah, this was an important hearing at the House Intelligence Committee that looked at the cyber threats to U.S. infrastructure. And during this hearing, Chairman Mike Rogers of the committee raised the issue of what about the threats to our infrastructure from cyber attacks from states like China and Russia. The commander, Mike Rogers, who's also the director of the NSA, really revealed, I think, for the first time probably, the vulnerabilities and activities that have been underway. He said that there are at least three countries, he was reluctant to name them, but he acknowledged that China was clearly one of them, that have been conducting reconnaissance on the networks and industrial control systems that control our electrical grid. And the implications of that are severe. He was basically stating that these penetrations were mapping how our grid functions and how to take down that grid in a conflict or a crisis in the future. This is clearly one of the most significant strategic threats facing the United States right now.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it's only one of several different ways that the grid could be attacked, but it is a particularly insidious one. There's also been reported malware introduced into control systems of our grid and that of European nations as well by the Russians. Bill, and Admiral Rogers participated, as I understand it, or simply oversaw war games that were taking place on how we contend with these sorts of threats. What did he say about that?
Well, I did a piece on that. The U.S. Cyber Command, which is the new command that's located at Fort Meade, where the NSA is also located, they held large-scale exercises at Nellis Air Force Base in Nevada. And they basically gamed out various attacks. Now, the reason this is significant is that, like NSA, the Cyber Command has really been totally under wraps. Everything they do is secret. So when they announced, as they did in a statement, that they were conducting these exercises, I felt it was pretty significant and wrote an interesting story that talked about the things that they did. They were sketchy on the details, but they clearly stated that they had various agencies and private sector entities involved in dealing with a cyber attack on critical infrastructure.
Well, I hope dealing with it doesn't simply mean trying to contend with it or respond to it, but actually preventing it from working its, you know, horrific consequences, particularly on our grid. Bill, you mentioned China as one of the particular malefactors with respect to mapping and possibly attacking the electric grid of the United States, which, just so we're clear, folks, I think everybody listening to this program knows, can create the sort of cascading and catastrophic failure of every critical infrastructure that we rely upon to feed ourselves, to get potable water, to deal with sewage and finance and transportation and telecommunications and so on. In short, everything that life in 21st century America depends upon. But China featured prominently. You also have written about a very important new report by the U.S.-China Economic and Security Commission, a congressionally mandated group. Talk about their new product, Bill.
Yeah, they produced on this week the latest annual report, and in it they were fairly stark in laying out the threats from China. And one in particular, which caught my eye and I wrote about in the Free Beacon today, it's on our website, talks about the expanding Chinese nuclear forces, a range of new missiles, new submarines, multiple warheads, and also hypersonic delivery vehicles for nuclear weapons. This is a major strategic threat that's getting worse. The report was fairly critical of the Pentagon for not releasing any details of the Chinese nuclear forces buildup since 2006, and they called on the Pentagon to be more forthcoming about that, to let people know what's going on out there. This is a major warfighting element of the Chinese military buildup that has gone completely unnoticed. As we talked about Chinese cyber and a lot of their conventional capabilities, very little has been said or written and published about their strategic forces buildup.
Yeah, and Bill Gertz, as you say, and thank God for the China Commission, because it really does do a second opinion on what's happening with the Chinese that is invaluable. And your reporting on it brings it to the attention of an awful lot of other people at the Washington Free Beacon and also at the Washington Times Inside the Ring. Bill, of course, the Chinese are not the only ones modernizing their nuclear forces. You have been reporting on what the Russians have been doing with respect to submarine-launched ballistic missiles. Turns out the North Koreans are, as you've been reporting as well. What is unmistakable here is that there is afoot at the moment a very substantial intensification of nuclear threats to this country in the hands of very dangerous regimes.
Yes, and I think a lot of the American people have been sidetracked by just the domestic debacles that have been perpetrated by the Obama administration. They're just beginning to understand, I think, and I'm trying to help with reporting on that, a lot of these national security and foreign affairs crises, I would say, that are taking place. And clearly the Russians, they just earlier this month tested a new submarine-launched ballistic missile that had multiple warheads, and also their strategic nuclear bombers in another, the latest provocation of nuclear saber-rattling, conducted a circumnavigation of the Pacific island of Guam just a week ago, and it was a day before the president met with Putin, albeit briefly, at the Brisbane G20 summit.
Yeah, Putin did not stay there long because he took so much grief off of the rest of the company. But Bill, and again, you do such important work by monitoring what these Russian bombers are doing in our air defense zones and over Guam in Europe. And now we're told in the Gulf of Mexico and the Caribbean is going to be a theater of operations for them as well. And what this all screams out is for a reconsideration of what the United States is doing with respect to its nuclear deterrent. Bill, I don't think we've talked about this, but Chuck Hagel had a major speech last week where he was talking about having to invest billions and really do a major overhaul of our nuclear sort of deterrent forces as well as systems. What is the upshot of that? Is there any modernization in prospect to speak of, or any other evidence that a course correction is underway with respect to the deterrent that's largely atrophied over the past 6 years?
Yes. More? Last week, the Defense Secretary outlined what they called the Nuclear Enterprise Review, and this review was commissioned following a couple of mishaps related to the handling of nuclear weapons and also some clear signs that our nuclear forces are facing serious problems. There was a cheating scandal on a proficiency examination at one of our nuclear missile bases, and this led to this review. And according to the people I talked to, there is a clear understanding that definitely this is a big problem, that it's going to require not just additional amounts of money, but also strong leadership to get the nuclear enterprise back on track. And from what I can tell, Hagel is serious about it. Again, this is a guy who is a global zero anti-nuclear advocate, but at least he's going through the motions and following the plans of what the military wants in terms of strengthening our nuclear deterrent.
Well, that is heartening if, in fact, he is going to engage in a kind of major sea change on his own part. But what about the president and the fact that he remains, as best one can tell, committed to ridding the world of nuclear weapons, as he's fond of saying, seemingly starting with ours? Bill Gertz, unfortunately, we're going to have to address that at greater length on another occasion, but thank you as always for your great work at the Washington Free Beacon and the Washington Times and here at Secure Freedom Radio. We look forward to our conversations with you, and we'll do so again next week. Next up, though, we have Andrew Bostom. He'll be giving us an insight into what the devil was going on, and I mean what the devil was going on at the National Cathedral a week ago, right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hello, folks. I'm Jim Hansen, and welcome to the Free Fire Zone. There was a time when nuclear Armageddon was the greatest threat facing mankind. The United States and Soviet Union faced off over arsenals so vast they could not only kill every man and woman on Earth several times over, but the planet herself was in jeopardy due to nuclear winter. But you don't hear much about that anymore, because we won the Cold War and the Soviet Union is no more. We won because America was strong. Not because of a naive belief that if we say enough nice things to our enemies, we can all just get along. The problem is that President Obama has forsworn American strength and spends his time apologizing for it or leading from behind. What he doesn't understand is that weakness invites our enemies to action, and they're taking action. Russian tanks rolled into the Ukraine last week. The Islamic State now runs a caliphate in Iraq and Syria. The Taliban are resurgent all across Afghanistan. And there's one threat that makes the rest of those seem minor in comparison. Iran is building a nuclear bomb. Everyone with an above room temperature IQ knows this, and the only real question is what to do about it. Try and stop them from finishing it, or hope they won't use it once they have it. It's obvious that President Obama has chosen hope. This may be the greatest failure of his debacle-filled time in office. Obama is obsessed with ridding the world of nuclear weapons, and he has been since his days back in college, staying up late, smoking and drinking, and solving all the world's problems. But the next day, you wake up with a hangover and nothing but echoes of John Lennon singing, "Imagine there's no countries, nothing to kill or die for." I mean, it's a catchy tune, but it's complete BS. The problem is, that mentality pervades the Obama White House, and his national security team has more political tools on it than practitioners of the arts of diplomacy and war. They're now hell-bent on securing a legacy for him and seem fixated on the idea that an Iranian nuclear deal is the mechanism. Now, I can't say if they actually believe that'll make the world a safer place. In their rainbow and unicorn world, it just might. But remember, the true purpose is not world safety, it's the legacy, and the danger is that we'll get a deal at any cost. The Iranians have violated every bit of every agreement that has ever been made, and there's no reason to believe that has changed. They need the economic sanctions we put in place lifted, because they're working. And they'll tell Obama's legacy-building crew whatever they need to hear to get the deal signed. And then the second the ink is dry, those centrifuges will just keep on spinning. Nuclear negotiations are the highest stakes poker game there is. It's not just money at risk, it's lives. Lots of them. The president used to brag that when he was back in the Illinois State Senate, he played poker with the good old boys there. Well, that brings to mind that old saying, Mr. President, if you don't know who the sucker at the table is, it's you. He's been getting played on the international stage for a long time. Right after he came into office, he folded our hand on missile defense in Poland and the Czech Republic to sign a bad deal with Russia. Then he offered Putin an even worse deal for us last year. He doesn't even really understand the game he's playing, and he proves it by making statements like, "Don't call my bluff." Even his court jester, John Stewart, knows that's a blunder.
I think when you're playing that hand, you're not supposed to tell the other guy, it's a bluff.
Whew. There may be a good deal to make with the Iranians, but this group seems highly unlikely to make it. And in their misguided need to make something happen, they seem to be saying, damn the torpedoes, full deal ahead. Well, those torpedoes may turn out to be missiles from the mullahs, and that's something that should scare all of us. I'm Jim Hansen, and you've been in the Free Fire Zone.
I lost my healthy 27-year-old son to influenza. Jacob wasn't someone you'd expect to die from the flu. He was strong, a martial arts athlete. After 5 weeks of fighting, Jacob died.
I'm Dr. Bill Schaffner of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. Each year, influenza claims the lives of Americans of all ages, including healthy young adults like Jacob. Ask about vaccination the next time you're at your doctor's office or pharmacy. Visit adultvaccination.org.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. I'm very pleased to say, joined by Dr. Andrew Boston. He is one of the most serious thinkers about and certainly writers upon the subject of jihad. He is the author of numerous books, including The Legacy of Jihad, The Legacy of Islamic Antisemitism, the very important and quite influential book Sharia versus Freedom. And he is, among other things, an accomplished physician, a Renaissance man, to be sure, but has been writing very importantly recently about something that we were anxious to talk with him about, which is civilization jihad inside the church. Andy Boston, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me on, Frank.
Specifically, you have been focused on kind of a case study of what happens when the Muslim Brotherhood or other civilization jihadists penetrate organized religions of other stripes, notably the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. Talk about what happened there a week ago when Islamists were doing a prayer service in that cathedral.
Well, I think the most important thing to take away is that whether they represent, you know, the vanguard of civilization jihad, or they're just invited in to do a prayer service, what we got was a real dose of traditional Islam as practiced, unfettered, inside a church. And it's true, the main khutbah sermon was given by the South African ambassador, Rasool, who is infamous, I guess, for being, I think, the first person in the United States to welcome the then Egyptian brother, Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood government. But what's important to underscore, Frank, is that all he really did is give a regular Friday service inside a church in what I would say is really traditional supremacist style, in that he was willing to invoke the central verse, the central theme of his khutbah, in fact, was Quran 3:26. Which I investigated, he actually read it in English, and it sounds rather anodyne, but in fact, if you look at how Muslims have been taught to interpret it through their great authoritative commentators across a span going from the Middle Ages to present, it really is a verse that was alleged to have been revealed around the time of the conquests, the Muslim conquests of both Byzantium Christianity and Zoroastrian Persia, and really in the modern era, as is made plain by the Grand Mufti of India at the time and an important 20th century commentator, he says that in these verses, Muslims have been taught and prompted to make a particular prayer, which in a subtle way gives an indication that they are going to overpower the disbelievers. And then he goes on to say that this augurs conquests in our era. So I think that that was a profoundly disconcerting thing to say at this ecumenical gathering, and it was immediately followed by the routine congregational prayer on Friday, which included, or I should say did not exclude, given the environment, Quran 1:7, which is a verse that is recited, 17 times a day by pious Muslims during their prayer services, but could have been omitted in this particular ecumenical setting, supposedly, because it is a curse upon Jews and Christians, Jews for having engendered Allah's anger, Christians for having gone astray. And again, this is what I demonstrated, is that this is the way Muslims have been taught to understand this particular verse, from ancient to modern times. And this simply could have been omitted.
Let me just ask, two questions occur. One is, does this not evince a contempt for the hosts of this event on the part of these, jihadists, that they would engage in this kind of practice so directly, so blatantly, so much in your face, point one? And point two, does this not suggest real, I don't know what to say, moral turpitude, malfeasance, incompetence, pick your term, on the part of their hosts? I can't figure out for the life of me what they were thinking when they brought this into their church.
All of those things, Frank, all of those things. I think the blame sits much more with the Episcopalian Church and its hierarchy for being so ignorant, whether it's willful or however they're just bereft of common sense understanding or anticipating, not even anticipating something like this. They've certainly had plenty of opportunity now to comment that, perhaps this was a disaster, but they were snookered a little bit right in the middle of the service. One of the things that Rasool did, which was an incredible act of taqiyya, this was pure dissimulation. He truncated Quranic verse 582. He read the latter half of it, which was actually praiseworthy towards Christianity, given his hosts. But what he omitted was the virulently anti-Semitic portion that opens up Quran 582, which is talking about the eternal enmity between Jews and Muslims, and also throwing in so-called idolatrous peoples, Hindus, etc., etc. This verse, Quran 582, is perhaps the central anti-Semitic verse in the Quran, and that was reaffirmed
last fall by the current grand imam of Al-Azhar University, Ahmed Al-Tayeb, who recited that verse and told Muslims that this is the source of the conflict between Jews and Muslims dating back 1,400 years.
Which you have documented extensively in your books, including The Legacy of Islamic Antisemitism. Andy Bostom, this really cries out for attention and corrective action, not just on the part of the cathedral here in Washington, but really churches across, and for that matter, synagogues across the country that have been engaging in this practice known as interfaith dialogue, or as the Muslim Brotherhood likes to put it, bridge building. There is a very, in addition to the extraordinarily important research and education that you've been providing us on what is being done in the name of Allah under these various services and prayers and injunctions, there is this admonition from Sayyid Qutb about bridge building. And might you share that with our audience as well? Because it really is such an object lesson in what these guys are up to. And every cleric in this country that is tempted to engage in this similar kind of interfaith dialogue or outreach should be on notice about it.
Well, dialogue is actually, I have to tell you that if I'm in the Vatican, for example, that have been engaged with this Muslim-Christian dialogue now for decades, actually know the score. I don't know why they continue to pursue it, but I will give you sort of a very humorous assessment of the dialogue from a Jesuit that I was told at Providence College, who was participant in it, again, at the Vatican level. And he said, yes, we tell the Muslims what a kind and beautiful religion Islam is, and they tell us what a kind and beautiful religion Islam is. And it just shows you that there is, at some levels, there's the appropriate cynicism about this, but to get, you know, without making light of it, to get to your point, yes, it's not just ideologues like Qutb, it's the whole mass movement that has been willing to promote Islam in this way as yet another form of conquest. What you saw, and Rasul was just incredibly overt about it. I was actually surprised that he went to the extent of quoting Quran 3:26. You know, it really told me that he dropped the mask. I thought, you know, the idea of sort of truncating Quran 5:82 and to play a little taqiya and then maybe throwing in Quran 1:7, it was going to be more subtle. But I was stunned.
And this is in keeping, the quote that I'm working for, and it's basically a paraphrase of Qutb, is that the chasm between Islam and the unbelievers is so vast that no bridge can be built to span it, except for the purpose of bringing the unbelievers to Islam. Andy Bostom, that's what we're up against. I think there's no question about it. And I appreciate tremendously your research and analysis and the extent to which you have helped illuminate this. I hope that this will become a teachable moment for others in this line of work, that both at the cathedral and beyond. And we look forward to helping expand upon that with you and others in the days ahead. We have to let you go for the moment, though. I hope you come back to us again soon, and I hope the rest of you will come back to us again next week. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.